Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Lawmakers are nearing a deal on the last tricky spending issues as the end of this year's legislative session approaches.
What we just want to see, and we have an agreement, is once you plug in the new funding formula, what it looks like on paper, but there is an agreement.
Also tonight, the fact the state budget was mostly crafted behind closed doors is drawing fire from a number of quarters in and around the Capitol.
What I said is that we are going to have the most open, the most accountable, the most transparent legislative session in the history of not only Florida, but of America.
We'll also get the rundown on what lived and what died as Florida lawmakers struggled to bring a somewhat unstable session, battling multiple crosswinds, in for something other than a crash landing in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Two more days this week, one extra day next week in the 2017 Florida lawmaking session. This is Capitol Report. The Florida legislature wasn't able to get it done on time, but leaders are nearing the finish line for the coming fiscal year's budget. Nick Evans reports drafters closed out numerous portions of the spending plan Wednesday after days of behind-the-scenes negotiations.
Late Tuesday, Senate President Joe Negron acknowledged what many around Florida's Capitol assumed.
So we will definitely not complete the budget work prior to the end of Friday, and so We'll continue to work diligently. We've made a lot of progress today in a number of budget areas, so I'm optimistic that we can continue that. But I think given the current schedule, it's improbable we'd be able to finish before Friday.
State law mandates a 72-hour cooling-off period between a budget's release and a vote. So Tuesday was the last day on which leaders could finish their work and still make it out on time. But legislators are making progress. Funding for education, the environment, and criminal justice are largely settled. House Budget Chief Carlos Trujillo says the health care budget has held up progress, but both sides have agreed on how to reduce Medicaid funding for hospitals.
We agreed to the model, and we're agreeing to the number. What we just want to see, and we have an agreement, is once you plug in the new funding formula, what it looks like on paper, but there is an agreement.
The plan will cut roughly $200 million in state funding, which means Florida will lose a total of about $500 million once federal matching dollars are added into the bargain. They've also squared away oversight for a $1.5 billion infusion to the low-income pool, a fund compensating hospitals for unpaid care. State administrators will develop a plan for the money, and if both presiding officers agree to reject it, those administrators will go back to the drawing board. Lat Valley explains originally, the House wanted either chamber to be able to reject the plan.
One of the concerns had been that potentially maybe, you know, the House might not be as eager to accept those federal funds as the industry is to get them.
But when it comes to the environmental budget, Latvala says a popular land buying program is getting zeroed out.
As the father of Florida Forever, as the person who passed that bill, I'm obviously disappointed to have a year when I'm appropriations chairman and not be able to fund it.
But he contends the spending plan represents a shift in focus rather than a rejection when it comes to land buying. He points to the reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee, Senate President Joe Negron's chief priority this year.
Well, obviously that is a area where we're committing a lot of funds on into the future, some of which were funds that we used to spend for land buying. But it's going to be spent for land buying. It's just down there. It's not, timberland in North Florida.
As lawmakers continue hammering out a budget, Governor Scott is touring the state, taking shots at the, quote, politicians in Tallahassee for passing legislation that threatens Florida jobs. Legislative leaders have so far proven lukewarm or out-and-out hostile to the governor's priorities. When the budget lands on Scott's desk, he'll have the option to reject the bill outright. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Florida lawmakers may have a budget, but that's come at the cost of a process that has in recent years been a lot more transparent than it is now. Lawmakers have struck deals largely in secret, seemingly backtracking on House Speaker Richard Corcoran's promise that this would be the most transparent process in legislative history. Len Hatter reports.
Back in March, House Speaker Richard Corcoran made this declaration.
What I said is that we are going to have the most open, the most accountable, the most transparent legislative session in the history of not only Florida, but of America.
And Corcoran is sticking to it.
Listen, every single thing that you're seeing in the budget, for the first time since the 68 Constitution, we now see it all. There was nothing that came in late, nothing that came in on the back of a napkin. The transparency level of the projects and the things that are being discussed, no longer in the conversations between the chairs, are they saying, they all had a different phrase for it. I have a new entrant, a new entry, well, what is it? Well, I really don't know, but it's 500 grand for this. All of that's gone. All of that last minute budgeting and the way we are doing it is no different than every single person has done it since 68.
But that's not how other lawmakers feel. Democrats like Lori Berman have tried to call out legislators for behind-the-scenes haggling on key issues, like Senate President Joe Negron's Central Florida Water Reservoir, which has not been heard in any House committee before it was presented on the chamber floor.
I move to refer SB 10, which was not heard by any House committees, to the House Subcommittee on Agriculture and Property Rights and the House Committee on Appropriations.
The effort to get committee hearings on the bill failed. As budget talks have unfolded, there have been growing concerns about how the state budget has been ironed out, a process largely done in secrecy among top lawmakers. Legislative leaders have reached deals and made trades on major policy proposals like Negron's Reservoir out of the public eye. Yet Senate Appropriations Chair Jack Ladvalla believes complaints were overblown, and he says there have been changes in how budget talks are done.
We've kept the subcommittee chairman involved. We make decisions about the subcommittees. They're involved along with me, along with the presiding officer. In the House, I know that Chairman Trujillo has been integrally involved even after these issues pumped up to the speaker. So there's a wider group involved here than just the presiding officers.
But the shroud of secrecy surrounding the state budget has caught the attention of the man whose job is whether to sign or veto it, Governor Rex Scott. The Florida Politics blog reports Scott is slamming the budget negotiation process and says he hasn't seen what's in it. Ladvalla's response?
And I can tell you that I personally talk to the governor's office staff 2 or 3 times a day. So they're involved. But they get the last lick, so they're going to be involved, and if they are unhappy with us, then they'll have the opportunity to reflect that with the final product. So I don't want them to be unhappy with me.
The governor may end up unhappy. Lawmakers are forging ahead with cuts to his favorite agencies, Enterprise Florida and Visit Florida. And they've also rejected his request for $200 million in repairs for the federally operated Herbert Hoover Dyke, which surrounds Lake Okeechobee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a gambling overhaul this legislative session has been taken off the table.
My interest in doing a gaming bill this session significantly decreases if we're not able to deploy the funds available that we're currently holding.
We'll unfurl our hankies and mourn the passing of the many bills whose cold remains lie scattered about the legislative chambers.
Joint Resolution 999 extends the legislature's power to impeach state officers for committing misdemeanors in office to include the state's 20 state attorneys and public defenders around the state.
And a plan to cut regulations for certain workers is heading to the governor's desk, but some of the workers who would be affected by the bill want to keep the rules the way they are.
My concern is that we, with this bill, we're bringing out quantity, but not quality.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Lawmakers have folded and left the table when it comes to passing a comprehensive gambling overhaul bill this legislative session, Regan McCarthy reports.
After years of waffling, the gambling discussion in the Florida legislature this session appeared to start strong, with members in both chambers indicating a commitment to pass sweeping legislation this year. Senator Bill Galvano expressed that commitment when he presented a gambling bill on the Senate floor.
And the people who would be part of this resolution, such as the Florida House, the Seminole Tribe of Florida, the governor's office, they also understand that at this point, inaction is not an option.
Galvano led his chamber's side of the gambling negotiations with the House. He and his House counterpart, Representative Jose Diaz, have been eyeing the impact a number of court decisions could have on the state's gambling landscape. Diaz says that concern was enough to cause his chamber, which is generally opposed to any gambling expansion, to consider a few compromises.
And if we really want to curb gaming and we want to have thoughtful, a thoughtful future for gaming in Florida, we would make some strides to expand a little so that we won't have to expand a lot.
In the end, Diaz says the two chambers couldn't see eye to eye on a number of issues, including blackjack and even bingo. But Diaz says one of the biggest sticking points was what to do about eight counties that have held referendums supporting the operation of slot machines in their communities.
Our speaker has been pretty consistent about referendum counties. He didn't want to expand massively, did not want to expand gaming massively, and he and a lot of others in the chamber felt that that was a massive expansion.
But Diaz points out the Senate also played a role in creating that impasse. Senate President Joe Negron has come out in strong support of giving those eight counties licenses to operate slots.
And it is not the place of the legislature to substitute our judgment for the judgment of voters.
Diaz says the timeline was another sticking point that made a deal too tough to reach this year, since the Senate had hoped to pass a gambling plan in tandem with the budget. And that's something Negron has mentioned before.
My interest in doing a gaming bill this session significantly decreases if we're not able to deploy the funds available that we're currently holding as a state that have been paid to us. These are the state funds.
Negron is talking about approximately $2 million the state has received from the Seminole Indian Tribe since its agreement allowing the tribe to offer blackjack expired. The tribe has continued to offer blackjack at its casinos and has continued to share its revenue with the state. The state has been holding that money in a separate account until a new deal with the tribe can be settled. But Galvano says there's nothing actually stopping lawmakers from using that money anytime they want. Meanwhile, Diaz is leaving open the possibility of a gambling special session, depending on how the courts rule in a pending case on those eight referendum counties. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Scores of bills are dead or dying as lawmakers bring the 2017 session to a bumpy conclusion. Ironically, the casualties include a measure that would have given the legislature the power to impeach prosecutors and public defenders. Jim Ash has more.
Technically, Republican Representative Jackie Toledo's proposal is called H.J.R. 999. It's pretty straightforward.
Joint Resolution 999 extends the legislature's power to impeach state officers for committing misdemeanors in office to include the state's 20 state attorneys and public defenders around the state.
The legislature already has the power to impeach the governor, lieutenant governor, cabinet members, state Supreme Court justices, and state judges. But the Constitution doesn't mention prosecutors and public defenders. Toledo essentially told the House Public Integrity and Ethics Committee, fair is fair.
This would also be leveling the playing field between state attorneys, public defenders, and judges who are subject to impeachment and bring them all to the same accountability level.
Toledo's ballot measure was a sleeper when she filed it in February. Only policy wonks seem to care about an arcane impeachment power, or for that matter, punishing prosecutors and public defenders. But that changed dramatically just a few weeks later, when Aramis Ayala, Florida's first African-American state attorney, shook the political world.
Fox 35 and the Orlando Sentinel. This is Orlando News Now.
Our state attorney caused quite a firestorm this week when she announced that she is not going to be pursuing death penalty cases at all.
Death penalty supporters were outraged, especially since Ayala's office was prosecuting a heinous double murder.
And most notably in the case of Markeith Lloyd, who shot and killed his pregnant ex-girlfriend and also police officer Deborah Clayton.
Florida PBA President John Rivera called Ayala a coward, while progressive groups praised her bravery. An angry Governor Rick Scott transferred the Lloyd prosecution and eventually a handful of others to a special prosecutor.
It bothers me. I just think every citizen deserves a state attorney that's going to fully prosecute cases. And so I want to thank Brad King for taking on the cases.
Ayala is asking the Florida Supreme Court to halt Scott's order and confirm her discretionary powers. Meanwhile, House and Senate leaders are slashing her budget by $1.3 million. But Toledo's resolution didn't get a single Senate hearing. During a House committee debate, Miami Beach Democrat David Richardson seemed suspicious.
So I'm just curious where this, what the genesis of this is. Do we have any instances of state's attorneys or public defenders that may be in need of corrective action?
Toledo insisted she had no specific case in mind, and it's not clear whether the measure would apply in the Ayala case. Officials have to be found guilty of a misdemeanor to be impeached, and Ayala has not been accused of a crime. But Republican Representative Chuck Clemons of Jonesville warned committee members, it's always better to be safe than sorry.
I believe that planning ahead is a lot better, and to recognize that there's a particular glitch here. Why would we wait until there's an event, an occurrence, some sort of untoward action?
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
There were also some bills passed that opponents wish had died during this year's lawmaking session. Local control advocates say the Florida legislature has taken preempting home rule to a new level this session. The legislature wants to extend property tax breaks, regulate vacation rentals, and community redevelopment agencies. Sarah Mueller reports all of that is not sitting particularly well with local elected officials.
The Florida Association of Counties sees dozens of pieces of legislation every year that limit home rule. That's when local governments can make its own laws. But Craig and Moss Deller of the association calls this year an assault on the idea of local control by House Speaker Richard Corcoran.
I think what was different this year was you had the leader in the House be the driver to strip home rule from local communities and bring it up to the state.
The legislature has approved an additional $25,000 homestead exemption for the 2018 ballot. If 60% of voters approve the constitutional amendment, it would take effect in 2019 and cost local governments more than $600 million. Moss Deller argues it's a tax shift, not a tax cut.
The majority of homeowners won't even see the benefit from this additional exemption, which on average is about $200 per homeowner per year. And so, unfortunately, it's a small benefit to a few homeowners and a pretty big hit to your local community and the services they provide.
Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum says the homestead exemption could mean the city provides less services. The gubernatorial candidate says it could hurt funding to the police department or to parks.
That is all the essential services that allow people to call Tallahassee home and feel proud about the kind of community we built here, which is why these are decisions that are best left to local governments.
House lawmakers have also approved a measure stopping cities and counties from banning vacation rentals. Under the legislation, local governments can't treat vacation rentals differently than other kinds of residences. Republican Representative Rick Roth says the legislature went too far in 2011 in barring local governments from regulating vacation rentals, and then went too far the other way in 2014 when the legislature reversed the rule. He is opposed to the bill.
So let's don't go too far again. We've already learned our lesson. We have to vote no on this bill. We went too far one time before, and this is going too far again.
Both the House and Senate bills grandfather regulations passed by localities before 2011. But some senators favor allowing cities and counties to regulate vacation rentals if two-thirds of voters approve it as a referendum. The Florida League of Cities supports local control of vacation rentals. Craig and Moss Deller of the Florida Association of Counties says it helped kill legislation that would have prevented local governments from passing business regulations.
We were thankful to see that it did not get a companion in the Senate, And we're certainly hopeful that this is a concept that will die.
A push moving the creation of community redevelopment agencies from local governments to the state legislature also appears unlikely to make it through both chambers. The Senate bill died in committee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
A school bus safety bill is now heading to Governor Rick Scott after passing the Senate this week. But as Sasha Cordner reports, it not only received bipartisan support, but some bipartisan opposition as well.
16-year-old Cameron Mayhew was walking to a stopped school bus. The bus's stop sign was out and its lights were flashing when suddenly
a vehicle illegally went through the stop of the school bus, struck Cameron Mayhew and killed him. His parents have lived with that loss since last summer when this occurred, and it was their idea to give people an understanding of the trauma that you go through as a parent of a child who have been killed by an irresponsible driver.
The driver who struck the Fort Myers High School student received what Mayhew's parents call a, quote, lenient sentence. An initial estimated $300 fine later bumped up to $1,000, a 6-month driver's license suspension, and driving school. Today, there are no enhanced penalties for passing a stopped school bus and injuring or killing another person. So Naples Republican Senator Kathleen Pasadomo says on top of any charges brought forth by a prosecutor, her bill, also called the Cameron Mayhew's Act, creates a minimum punishment. Under the bill, the 120 hours of community service would have to be done in a hospital or a trauma center. But using an example, St. Petersburg Republican Jeff Brandis questioned Pasadomo about that provision.
So we understand, if someone is 80 years old and they were to make this, we would make the 80-year-old go to a trauma center and serve 120 hours in a trauma center. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. And actually, my dad is 94, volunteers at a trauma center, so it worked for him, and he didn't hit anybody.
Right. Still, while he understands the bill's intent, Brandis says he believes the bill goes too far regardless of age.
But how traumatic that would be. And then to stack on top of that the ability to have to go to a trauma center to me and to have that experience replayed over and over again.
But Orlando Democratic Senator Victor Torres says raising the penalties is crucial to deterring that behavior. In fact, a bill he filed this year stalled in the committee process to increase penalties from a civil violation to a reckless driving charge for people who pass a stopped school bus on the side where kids enter or exit.
And we need to continue getting better bills, and this is one of them. And there are reckless drivers out there that don't care. They do it every day. They pass these school buses.
And Ocala Republican Senator Dennis Baxley says the bill might even be therapeutic.
I like the tangible part of actually a therapeutic model that you do something to help compensate for what's occurred out of your negligence or mistake.
And the measure passed the Senate Monday, 28-6. The no votes included Brandis and Gibson. And since the bill also received unanimous passage in the House, it's now awaiting the governor's approval. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, tonight, after years of debate, the legislature has decided to deregulate a slate of professions. Cosmetologists to geologists to boxing announcers could have a better shot now at starting a business. But Kate Payne reports some of those same workers have doubts about the reforms.
Monticello Republican Representative Halsey Bashirs thinks it's too hard to break into the beauty industry in Florida.
It takes an EMT 325 hours to get a license. It takes a cosmetologist 1,200 hours, and the student loans are, if they can go from $5,000 to $20,000.
The devil's advocate might say maybe our emergency medical technicians need more schooling. But Bashirs and his conservative colleagues see these occupational licenses as a stumbling block for the economy.
I represent first-generation Americans, minorities, lower-income individuals who are simply trying to pursue the American dream, but they can't take a year off from their job to go jump through a bunch of arbitrary hoops. It's ridiculous.
That's Justin Pearson, a lawyer with the Institute for Justice. He's supporting the plan to roll back licensing and training rules for certain workers.
It does eliminate individual licenses for labor organizations, boxing announcers and timekeepers, hair oppers, hair braiders, body wrappers.
That's bill sponsor Senator Kathleen Passidomo, a Naples Republican. The measure would also cut business licenses for
yacht and ship broker, branch offices, architecture businesses, landscape architect businesses, asbestos businesses, interior design businesses. It does not eliminate the licenses for the individuals who practice the business.
Even the Obama administration wanted to roll back these licenses, but some like the rules as they are. Miami Gardens Democratic Representative Barbara Watson used to own a beauty salon. She says barbers and cosmetologists do hundreds of hours of training for a reason, public health.
I had a client come into my salon, which had a contagious disease. Had we not been able to identify it immediately, it could have spread it within the community very rapidly.
When it comes to hiring, employers don't want to sacrifice quality for quantity. Stephanie Bors is a salon owner and has taught cosmetology. She says it takes time to learn her line of work.
You are asking salon owners to assume the liability of people who have not had hands-on training, who have not had hands-on technical education.
Her husband and business partner, Joseph Bors, says he already has to retrain new hires as it is.
Lowering the hours is costing me as a salon owner more money because I have to train these individuals when they come into my salon.
And the changes are making some of the state's interior designers nervous, too. They work with engineers and architects to design commercial buildings like schools and hospitals.
What this bill does is it doesn't deregulate us, it regulates us even tighter and forces us to work under architects. It also limits the public's choice in terms of the type of person they can hire.
That's Lisa Waxman, chair of Florida State University's Interior Design Department. Her testimony worries Republican Representative Thad Altman.
This could increase the cost to consumers dramatically.
Altman says the change could actually reduce market competition.
Because work that they would normally go to a licensed interior design, a highly trained licensed interior designer, that may not be around for them anymore, and they would have to go to a larger, more expensive architectural firm to have that work done.
Ultimately, lawmakers decided to cut regulations, despite professionals' concerns. The Senate voted the bill forward unanimously Wednesday. The House has already approved the plan, and it now heads to the governor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.